Welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I am your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share some of the tips and tricks and strategies and blueprints. I tell stories. I share my mistakes that I've made along the way, all with the hopes that you have something that you can use in your own classroom. Because ultimately, I believe that teachers have the power to spark creativity in their students. Today, we're going to be talking about this idea of project-based learning. And this is something I am passionate about. It's the idea that every student deserves access to PBL. And so I want to start with a story of a friend of mine. He was actually my boss, but he became a really good friend. And I love this example of what he did. So years ago, my friend Chad, Chad Segerston is his name. He's still a principal over in Phoenix. But Chad started the 21st Century Classroom Initiative in our school district. Teachers would be part of a six-person team where they would attend professional development. They received state-of-the-art technology, which at the time was like iPads and iPod touches. And they would have a learning coach who would help them implement student-centered learning. We focused on things like design thinking and project-based learning. But this was not the gifted cluster. This initiative was only available for teachers who taught the ELL classes. We focused our professional development on how to integrate language acquisition strategies into PBL and into writers' workshops and inquiry-based learning and other student-centered approaches. Meanwhile, Javi and Sarah helped redesign the rote-based, skills-based ELL summer school into something that was creativity-infused. It was a summer STEM camp, and suddenly we had kids who were excited about being there. Our philosophy was simple, and I love the fact that I got to be a part of this process. It was the idea that ELL students deserved access to the same student-centered projects that the gifted students were already doing. Soon after, a colleague, Jen, led the way in special education, and she showed that you could blend universal design with things like blogging and podcasting and other student-centered learning. This 21st Century Initiative was a hub in an unlikely space with an unlikely group of students. Our ELL students had genuine voice and choice. It was truly powerful. But this initiative is not the norm. In our district, it was more common for gifted students to use technology for project-based learning and inquiry-based learning. But the ELL students, not so much. The gifted students got to use their devices to connect with authors on Skype or to experts through email. Meanwhile, many of the ELL and special education students used adaptive learning programs that delivered digital worksheets for reading intervention programs. Instead of designing and creating and problem solving, they spent hours in isolation doing multiple choice tests and rote practice. As I work with pre-service teachers, I've continued to see this trend. Low-income students, ELL students, special education students, they're less likely to experience these student-centered projects, the kind that truly empower them with voice and choice. And I think that's kind of sad, because I think it takes a deficit mindset toward students. In some cases, the lack of access is due to implicit bias. I've heard teachers say things like, I just don't think my ELL students are ready for something like project-based learning, or my special education students are too low. They'll just get frustrated. Sometimes they reference issues with classroom management, and often it's the idea that somehow projects are simply too advanced for certain students. This implicit bias reinforces the creative chasm. It's the belief that PBL is for the advanced students, but exceptional learners and ELL students, nah, they don't need that. They just need the basics. Often there's a philosophy that basic skills have to come before you ever develop soft skills. Or it's the assumption that somehow PBL is a free-for-all. But PBL is something valuable. It's a way to learn the content through the project. It's not something you do like as dessert after the, quote, real learning has happened. Meanwhile, we know that PBL can lead to moderate increases in academic achievement, and it can lead to a higher retention of information. Meaningful projects can boost student engagement and increase student agency and self-direction. But this requires teachers to believe that all students deserve access to projects. See, when I first started out on my PBL journey, I was worried about that. Could all students actually do this? Or what would classroom management look like? Or what will the principal think of me? And so on and so on and so on. And yet, I learned that it works. I taught in a high-stakes environment. PBL sounded great, but the state test was a 2-ton elephant in the room. Actually, it wasn't really an elephant. It was more like the Demogorgon from Stranger Things, dark and invisible, its claws pulling people into the underworld of isolation and disengagement. That's what I experienced on a regular basis. We had a strong focus on academic achievement, which made PBL feel really, really risky. In other words, sometimes ELL and special education students don't have access to PBL because teachers are afraid. We're stuck with these policies that make it really scary to take that leap. And this creative chasm that develops, it becomes this gap between the makers and the takers, and it has long-term consequences. We know that when students engage in authentic PBL, they have increased agency and ownership. They're more excited and engaged in their learning. And when this happens, they retain their information for a longer amount of time while learning vital tech skills like digital citizenship and information literacy. However, they also learn vital soft skills like collaboration and communication and curation and problem solving. As they work through these iterations and revise their work, they develop a growth mindset, and often they learn how to seek out constructive feedback. That's what we want for students. Yes, all students, even ELL students. Yes, even special education students. Yes, even low-income students. All right, so how do we actually make it happen? Here's a couple thoughts. Number one, teach students to self-select the scaffolds. This is the idea of building scaffolds that all students can use and then allowing any student to access that. What happens is you end up with less stigma attached to selecting a scaffold. Needing help isn't suddenly something that kids have to be afraid of. They're not embarrassed in front of their peers. It's the idea of designing scaffolds, whether it's a tutorial that you create, an online tutorial, it could be anchor charts that you make, it could be some flipped learning videos with instructions, it could just be the availability of small groups and you call any student up who needs some extra help. But whatever it may be, you allow all students to do that. And what you're teaching a lot of the students who are exceptional learners is how to self-advocate, how to seek out those scaffolds when they need them in life. I kind of alluded to it, but number two is to pull small groups. If you have students working in projects, they're really going to hit a place where they're working pretty independently. And the upside of that is you can easily pull a small group for 10, 15, 20 minutes, really short mini lessons, 4 kids, 5 kids, and you do those interventions that they need. Maybe it's a design thinking project and you're going to teach students how to draw conclusions and make inferences while doing research. Maybe it's a particular math project. It's a tiny house project and you still have students who are struggling with proportional reasoning and you're going to pull them aside for a mini project. Number three is to build interdependency into the projects. So one of the things I've done is I have this brainstorming process, and each student brainstorms by themselves first, then they move into a group, they narrow it down, they move to other groups. And what you'll see if you check out the video connecting to the blog post that goes with this podcast is that there's interdependency built into it. Independence is when kids are working on their own, and that's great. There are times when you want them to be independent. And dependence is when they're depending on others for help. And sometimes they need that. That's why we still do direct instruction. That's why we still have guided practice. But interdependence is when they are depending on one another, where every student's help builds the entire group to a new level. So one way to do this is if you're teaching students how to do research, you have each student generate a set of questions. And it doesn't matter, you know, some kids are going to have 20 questions, some kids are going to have 3. And they're not getting graded on how much they do. They're just all generating questions. Then they pull the questions all together. So the questions are all in a group. And then what you do is you have students with specific roles. So the students who struggle a bit, they can determine which questions are on topic or off topic. Another one could figure out, is it fact-based question or is it an opinion-based question? But then it gets a little bit tougher. Is the question specific enough? That's for your sort of mid-level to high-level student. And then that student who tends to dominate, their job is to be the quality control person, and they wait and they watch. They don't offer any feedback until the very end when they look at each person's feedback on each question. And what I do is all three group members have a star. They put a star next to each question. And so all the ones with 3 stars, a star for specific, a star for on topic, and a star for fact-based, the quality control person can then look at the 3-star questions and give the nod for yes, it's good, or the thumbs up for yes, or just the feedback for yes, it's a good research question, or no, I really don't think it fits what we're trying to do. And it helps to give each student a different color, and you can kind of see it, and they can discuss and debate if they need to. But again, notice that's interdependency. Every single student has a job, they have a role, they have something that they can do. Number 4, honor each student's expertise. Every single student has something that they can bring to the group. And this is the opportunity to honor their expertise and to allow them to share something. It's what I love about Genius Hour. It's a chance to do a project where maybe a student struggles with, say, reading and writing, but they are experts at something and you can tap into their expertise. On a more content-specific subject like science or social studies, you can figure out, in that case, maybe it's what are they the most comfortable with doing in terms of expertise? So maybe they can make videos, they can make podcasts, things like that. And so again, with something like language arts, there's a lot of leeway on topics. For social studies and science, there might not be as much leeway on the topics, but there's a lot of freedom and flexibility in terms of how they share what they're learning in terms of the methodology. And so it's honoring their expertise either in their methodology and what they know how to create or in what topics they know well. A small example of that would even just be doing something like a Genius Hour where you honor their questions that they have and their inquiry and you tap into that. This Wonder Week project is a really small example of that, right? You have students create a Wonder Week. They ask any question connecting to the subject. And from there, it taps into that background knowledge that they already have. Number 5, this is probably the most obvious answer here. It's to partner with your ELL and special education teachers. They know the most about it. They know which types of accommodations your individual students need. In general, I would say this, for ELL, you're going to want to front load vocabulary, provide additional think time. You're going to allow them to work on something first individually before moving into a group. It might involve translating help or partnering with someone who's multilingual, incorporating resources in their first language if possible. Sometimes it's leveled sentence stems that help them with discussions and writing. Sometimes it's a mini lesson on something like verb tenses. I found that to be really helpful in doing research to teach all 16 English language verb tenses, because it will allow students to access the language. Using visuals within the projects to help facilitate language development, using tech tools, So, you know, again, if you have those videos or audio explanations, you can have them slow down the videos and audio and listen to it at a slower place where they can really understand the language. A simple thing is just to pay attention to their affective filter and to reduce the fear and anxiety they might experience in doing a collaborative project. The idea, though, is this. There's so many strategies out there, and that's just for ELL. For special ed, it's even broader, right? You have to look at their IEP and see, but it might involve additional handouts or helping facilitate task analysis and executive function, pulling small groups for interventions, differentiating the tasks within the groups. So I gave that example of the four different members judging the questions. Providing assistive technology when needed, having them specific tutorials and tools that would allow exceptional learners to have easy access to them, and then also sort of walking them through and modeling for students, for special education students, how to access those tools and tutorials. Being flexible with deadlines and requirements, all of those are ways to make it happen. Ultimately, every student deserves access to meaningful PBL, but it does take time and intentionality to make it truly inclusive. And this is why it helps to partner with teachers who are ELL or special ed certified. It will never be perfect. There will always be room to grow and improve, and that's okay. But when we embody the ideal of PBL for all, we create a more inclusive PBL environment. And by empowering all students in the present, we're preparing them for a lifetime of learning. Thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or any place that you get your podcast? That would mean the world to me. Again, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.